We are talking once again with Joff Parrish, local writer and activist, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
So I saw on social media last night on Facebook that after you're getting back from dialysis, you apparently had a little adventure. Tell us about that.
Dialysis involves sticking two needles in you and then using them to, you know, rinse your blood through. So there's a venous and an arterial, and the arterial wound, which, you know, normally clots and heals after the session, decided to unclot itself. It looked a little bit like the Dark Knight from Monty Python and the Holy Grail, where it just sort of squirts out. And so the paramedics prevented me from bleeding out, which I'm grateful for. And my partner also played a pivotal role. She did all the right things, applied a tourniquet and all the rest of that. And so, yeah, here I am. You know, if it bleeds, it leads. So here we go.
Yeah, and again, just one of the many adventures you
read. I'm really stubborn. You know, as anybody who knows me can attest, yeah.
All right.
I keep trying to, you know, agitate for a better world, even though it hasn't really worked yet.
Yeah, well, it sounds like it was a darn good thing you're partner was close enough by to observe what was going on, because she reported that you were, while she was applying a tourniquet, that you were passing out off and on through the entire process.
It wasn't while she was doing it, but by the time the paramedics got here, I was not passing out, but getting pretty faint.
Okay.
So it was. That was the only point at which I kind of got alarmed, but we dealt with it, so all yeah. Good.
All
spent
right.
Spent a few hours in the ER, and you know I'm all plugged up now, so all good.
All right. Well, let's move on to this week's other news, starting with Seattle and the concrete driver's strike. Got an update.
The concrete driver's strike is not settled yet, unlike the initial reporting in the Seattle Times. But the Teamsters Local 174, which is who represents the concrete drivers, and this is a strike that's been going on for like 3 months, offered to allow some of its workers to go back to work while they continue to negotiate. And the developers who they're negotiating with have not responded yet, so far as I know. They had 5 days legally to respond. This is all, you know, laid out legal process and all that. What the offer from the local was to have the drivers begin working again at job sites having to do with infrastructure. So things like the light rail expansion, which of course is under construction in several points, you know, things like the West Seattle Bridge and some of the other, you know, critical projects that have been held up by this strike. So that I think is a positive development, and hopefully it means negotiations are getting closer to having a resolution, and we'll keep an eye on that.
Yeah, I saw that as a positive development, and a fairly generous offer on the side coming from the side of labor to cooperate.
Yeah, yeah. I don't ever remember seeing anything exactly like that before.
So. Yeah, I don't either. So saw it as a potentially good sign. So.
Mm-hmm.
All right, moving on the. Seattle's Office of Inspector General, OIG, came out with another report this week.
Yeah, their office has been conducting a review of the behavior of SPD during the 2020 demonstrations on Capitol Hill and downtown, after the murder of George Floyd. And of course, you know, they're it's very timely at this point because nobody really remembers or cares, other than the people who were involved. But they were quite critical of SPD's behavior during those demonstrations. The focus of this particular tranche of review was mostly the area around 11th and Pine, which is a block down from where the East Precinct building is. The takeaways include that massive distrust of SPD, which goes back decades, and the department's flawed flawed response to the demonstrations were the biggest problem. It led the transformation of protests over George Floyd's murder into anti-police demonstrations, which I don't think is entirely true. I mean, there was always the focus on racial justice. Now that it's true that the police made themselves targets of demonstrators' anger as well by their behavior, that part is definitely true. The tactics that the OIG was critical of include tear gas, blast balls, and fixed barriers blocking streets. It made for an unsafe environment for police protesters and residents of the surrounding Capitol Hill neighborhood, which is very true. You know, it took 2 years for an oversight body of SPD to come to really obvious conclusions. The police made the situation much worse. And in many instances, it seemed like that was their intent, was to make the situation worse. Now, what I would love to see is an investigation of SPD's non-response to emergency situations, not only within the protest zone, and hopefully they'll address this in a future review, but also the surrounding Capitol Hill neighborhood. You could not get a cop to come if anything happened within like six blocks of the CHOP zone for much of that summer. And this included several fatal shootings, most of which in the media were blamed on CHOP because the person who was shot died. And because SPD and stood by, and that means that the paramedics stand by because they won't go into a protest zone unless they have a police escort. They don't want to be targets themselves. So hopefully they'll review that in the future, and hopefully it won't take more time than it's already taken.
Yeah, I haven't had a chance to read the report yet, but I know it also focuses on the impacts of the tear gas use on the crowd, as well as on residents of apartment buildings that were nearby, and mentions and the incident where the brother of an SPD officer drove a car into a crowd of protesters and shot a man who was trying to stop him before he finally surrendered to police. So,
And surrendering to police by just, you know, walking over to them and basically shaking their hands, and they didn't tackle him, they didn't shoot him. Even though he'd shot somebody moments ago in front of their eyes, they didn't really do anything other than, you know, take him out to lunch or something. So,
it was interesting at this week's Community Police Commission meeting, there was some discussion of a letter that had been sent to OPA from the CPC regarding concerns of the residents. We just talked about the apartment building that got tear gas from the residents of Sunset Electric Apartments, which is on the same block as the East Precinct. And
We should say, in case people are drowning in acronyms, there are three SPD oversight bodies. These are the other two you're talking about, the Office of Police Accountability and the Community Police Commission.
Thank you. Yeah. Because it's easy to get lost in this stuff.
which I think is much of the point, actually.
Yeah, I agree. So they were in fact recipients of an ex- extensive quantity of tear gas that was fired by SPD that ended up drifting into their building. The building apparently has a large open air entrance, entryway and kind of community space that some newer buildings, like some older buildings have. It's not unusual. That ended up filling up with tear gas, and then that tear gas drifted upwards into the apartments above. So these people were like marinating in tear gas just by their proximity to
that sounds unpleasant.
Yeah. And again, remember that there were reports of people who had been exposed to the tear gas that ended up having physical problems afterwards, including like missing their periods for extended periods of time.
Wow.
That anyway, was reported in numerous people that were exposed. And I'm not sure if any of the residents of Sunset Electric Apartments experienced that. But again, there's clearly issues with exposure to the tear gas. So anyway, so they were had major concerns regarding the makeup of what was in the tear gas, and it came up during the meeting that SPD can't really talk much about what happened with Sunset Electric because they're in a legally maneuvering with them to find a supposedly a resolution, but it turns out the representative for SPD, who regularly attends these meetings, not necessarily, he isn't a member of the commission, said that SPD used four different types of tear gas during the summer of 2020, and they're having trouble finding out exactly like what was deployed where and when and what quantities and things like that, because I guess it's pretty hard to keep track of things like that when you're just shooting them off pretty yeah, rapidly. So
I remember in Portland and I think in Seattle as well, demonstrators were complaining that, you know, this stuff isn't tear gas. This is something more toxic. Mm-hmm. And, you know, never getting a clear answer from law enforcement as to what exactly they were getting sprayed with. And people having a lot of adverse health reactions. So I'm not surprised that the residents in the area had the same problems.
Yeah, and the SPD rep said, well, you know, you can go to the manufacturers, the places that we purchased it from, and they put that information up on their website. And it's like, well, yeah, you're assuming they're actually putting up accurate information, for one, you know.
Yeah.
So without like...
And you're assuming that you're telling us accurate information, number two.
Exactly. So so that was interesting. And the other interesting note regarding Sunset Electric Apartments is that they are trying to get a response from the city, whether it's the OPA or SPD or whoever, as to when the SPD made the decision to abandon the East Precinct because of fears that the East Precinct could be targeted and burnt to the ground, like the in Minneapolis, I believe, was.
Yes.
That them being on the same block in close, and the buildings being in close proximity, if not touching in certain areas, why there was no effort by SPD to contact them to alert them to the fact that their building might also potentially face serious threat of fire due to its proximity to the East Precinct. So they're wanting some answers on that as well. So
yeah, and you know, bear in mind that all of this has to do with those missing texts that Mayor Durkan and various other high officials, Carmen Biss, etc., deleted. We don't know what the decision-making chain was. We got a very belated answer where SPD basically threw a site commander under the bus. But you know that consequential decision, which was basically made national news, was cleared with people higher than a site commander in the police department.
Yeah, you would think.
So, particularly when you're dealing with Mayor Durkin, who is a famous micromanager. In fact, she, she lost a lot of staff people over her tendency to micromanage situations. So, she had her hands in that. But they covered their tracks, and those tracks have not been uncovered yet. And that was in violation of state law, and we'll talk about that in a minute too, because that situation has come up again. I'm sure that the apartment would love to know what the decision making chain was on that and why they weren't notified. If that was in fact the reason the East Precinct was abandoned. Because we don't know that either for a fact, because there's really nothing that you can trust coming out of the city on that situation.
Yep. All right. Well, let's move along. Matt Shea, former state representative, made the news this week.
Yeah, and Shea is in legal trouble. He resigned last year. Because he's in a lot of legal hot water, because he's been accused of being a domestic terrorist, because he's been hanging out for years with Proud Boys and Aryan Nations and various other folks that may be based in northern Idaho, but also have a lot of fans in the Spokane Valley area, which is right by the northern Idaho border. Shea is a far-right Trump acolyte, who has been hanging out with Ammon Bundy and some of those folks. And he was in the news this week again because now he's in Poland, of all places, and he is trying to bring back 62 Ukrainian kids who have been separated from their parents or have been orphaned by the conflict over there, which we'll talk about shortly. And he's been bypassing all the official channels and trying to do this. Now, you know that he's trying to place those kids with Christian households. Adopting foreign kids is a big cottage industry in the far right. And you know that LGBTQ parents, for example, need not apply. And I'm sure most of the folks listening to the show need not apply either. So this is raising alarm among a lot of the legitimate adoption agencies who, obviously, right now, there's a massive effort going into dealing with the 3.3 million and counting refugees from that conflict that are now in foreign countries, mostly in Eastern Europe. Most official adoption processes have stopped at this point. They're just trying to house people temporarily because of the ongoing crisis. So what is Shea doing? You know, because he is a Trump acolyte, that this is all about the grift. And you know he's trying to make money off of this. But is he trying to do a good thing? Maybe, in his bass-ackward way. I mean, he is a smart dude. He's not as stupid as a lot of his admirers, let's put it that way. This is very, very fishy. Would not surprise me if it landed him in legal trouble again.
So, moving on, there was an inquest that began this week, inquests regarding police shootings that are very rare.
Well, they're about as rare as police shootings themselves. What's rare is that they find anything other than that police actions were justified. And that almost never happens, honestly. And then, the prosecutor can say, well, the coroner found that it was justified, so I'm not going to prosecute. The whole system is rigged that way. And then, families wind up filing a civil lawsuit, and the city winds up settling with them because, in fact, the shooting was awful. as, you know, judges and juries, once it finally gets to a judge or a jury, usually conclude. So the coroner's process itself has been on hold since 2017, which was 2 years before the pandemic. So I'm not sure why this was something that's been on hold for that long. But it's the first inquest since 2017, and it began hearing testimony on Tuesday. Now, this had to do with the fatal shooting of a 19-year-old black kid, not a kid, he's an adult legally, named Darius Butts, who apparently held up a convenience store downtown, and for his troubles was chased down by police. They fired. So you know it's going to be found to be a justified shooting. He wound up injuring three officers. Four different officers used their weapons that day. So, you know, he didn't have much of a chance. And, as reprehensible as, you know, armed robbery is, it's not a capital offense. The question will be examined, in theory anyway, of whether this was a justified shooting. In this process, the families are not allowed to have an advocate give testimony. All they can do is watch. So an advocate for the police obviously gives testimony, and that's about it. And that's the information the juries are given. So people have been trying to reform this process for a very, very long time. Presumably, they'll come to a decision in the next week or two, and we'll let you know. But I'm letting you know right now what the decision is likely going to be, because the process is really that skewed. Mm.
And as we've mentioned before on this show, the whole concept of coroners, I'm not sure specifically about King County coroner, I can't speak to that, but in general, coroners can be elected positions, they can be appointed, and the prerequisites to being a coroner are pretty relaxed in a lot of communities, given how important that position is to, you know, the whole
that justice. You have to be a warm body, which seems kind of counterintuitive, since most of the people you're dealing with are not warm bodies in that job. But you don't have to be a doctor. You don't have to be, you don't have to have any kind of specialized training, which is weird.
Yeah. So, again, just,
you know, you'd think that there'd be some kind of coroner's school or correspondence coroner's course where you get a certificate. I mean, it's something.
Yeah. At least, you know, something you can get a scholarship from Trump University from. So
exactly.
So, all right. Okay, moving along. Melissa Santos at Crosscut this week had a great story about further problems with the Washington State Redistricting Commission.
Yeah, we talked about the Redistricting Commission at some length and some of the problems they ran into when they published their findings and their redistricting plan a few hours late on November 16th rather than November 15th of last fall, as they were required to. Their defense that, well, we had agreed to it by November 15th. Well, you're supposed to publish it according to the law. There were some additional problems that were found as well. It appears that not only did the commission short-circuit public hearings and, any kind of public input in the process, which they're also required to do in state law, but dozens of the text messages, I told you we'd get back to this, mm-hmm. between commissioners and legislative staff, they're not supposed to be involved in the redistricting process. It's supposed to be totally apolitical, but you know that it's not. So dozens of those text messages were not released as public records when Crosscut sought them as part of a public records request immediately after the redistricting plan was announced. They simply forgot to include them. According to the commission's executive director, some of those text messages have been deleted. That in turn would be a violation of that same state law that is probably not going to be prosecuted. One of the redistricting commissioners, a woman named April Sims, deleted many of her text messages before the request came in, most likely on the morning of September 16th when the plan was made public.
November 16th,
that's what I was trying to say, when the plan was made public. So, you know, this again is a political process or a process that has huge political implications in any event, as did the abandonment of the East Precinct, where public officials involved really wanted to cover their tracks. And you have to ask the question, why? You know, what are they hiding? And this is why we have sunshine laws like the requirement that you preserve text messages or other forms of communication, written communication. So, and this is why people like Donald Trump make sure never to write anything down. You know, it's sort of the mob boss approach to governing. And this is what we saw with the Durk administration, and apparently this is what we're seeing with this redistricting commission too. It's very discouraging. That is supposed to be an impartial body, or at least a body to be, you know, it is comprised of an equal number of Democrats and Republicans, and they're supposed to behave non-politically.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, good luck with that. Moving on. Interesting kind of side note item that Vulcan Real Estate is getting sued over.
Yeah, I'm not sure what to make of this. Now this had to involved a so far unsolved shooting in the Central District at 23rd and Union, which is seeing a massive redevelopment. In recent years, there was a Red Apple there that they've torn down, and a huge Vulcan project that will include an Amazon Fresh store on the ground floor and a bunch of other perks. That is, you know, sort of Exhibit A for gentrification of a neighborhood. But the Central District, unlike what old hands like you and I remember it as when it was heavily African-American, it's 90% Caucasian now. It is totally transformed in the last 20 years or so. Actually, more like 30, but especially the last 10. Mm-hmm. Because of its proximity to downtown, its location, you know, a lot of apartment buildings and large complexes have been built in the last 10 years. And Exhibit A for that is the corner of 23rd and Jackson. So there is a Starbucks there and a Walgreens there on the northeast corner. And then the Vulcan project is on the southeast corner. And the family of the shooting victim in this case amended their lawsuit this past week to include the company that manages the parking lot for the Walgreens and the Starbucks, and there's an auto parts store and some other stuff on that corner, and also because that management company retains the security company that patrols that parking lot, so they're included in this lawsuit, and I think Vulcan is included in the lawsuit simply because they have a lot of money. And they're alleging negligence and that you know, somehow that parking lot should have been patrolled more and that would have somehow prevented the shooting. This seems to me like a really dubious lawsuit. I don't think it's going to go very far. But it's interesting that the property developer and the property developer across the street are trying to be held accountable for this shooting, which, you know, happens in a matter of seconds. I don't know how you prevent something like that, or certainly how a property developer, you know, prevents something like that. The parking lot where the Starbucks and the Walgreens and all that are, that's been there for at least 10 years. So it's not a new development at all. And, you know, it's not a particularly bad corner the way, say, 12th and Jackson is. It was interesting to see that lawsuit being amended last week.
All right. Washington State Legislature has completed their a year that many are seeing as not the banner year they had hoped for.
No, it really was kind of a failure. And this was not a surprise. This year was a 60-day session, which, given that legislators are introducing and considering literally thousands of bills, and they're supposed to be able to process that in 60 days, I think the idea of a part-time legislature, which was written into the state constitution, which, when Washington was a pioneer state, they were anticipating a mostly agrarian economy, not a modern economy that trades all over the world, it really is outdated. And, you know, the legislature really needs to move to being a full-time legislature. And unfortunately, that's not in the cards. But what you get instead is a very short legislative session. And, you know, it's tempting to blame Democrats for this, because they should have prioritized a lot of stuff that they say they're for. And a lot of those types of bills didn't get through. But, you know, it's a tsunami of bills. It really is. It's impossible to consider everything. And a lot of stuff gets buried, doesn't make it out of committee, et cetera. So I want to go over some of the major areas that are probably of concern to our listeners, mm-hmm. and talk about what didn't make it this year. Let's start with housing and homelessness. There are a couple different bills that didn't make it. HB 1782 in the House would have allowed denser housing statewide, and HB 1660 would have allowed accessory dwelling units statewide, both of which could have helped the state increase its housing stock. Instead, nothing will happen for another year on that front. One bill that did make it, sponsored by Frank Chopp in Seattle, attempts to connect people under the state's Apple Health, which is a Medicaid program, with permanent supporting housing. That was HB 1866. That did pass. So on climate change, Democrats used a transportation budget, because they did have to pass not a full budget, but amendments to previous budgets this year. And they also passed a transportation bill, which Maria talked about a few weeks ago, a budget for transportation package. They used that package to try and reduce the state's overall emissions by investing in electrified ferries, expanded transit systems, and better bike and pedestrian infrastructure around the state. So that was good news. They got that through. HB 1918 did not get through, however. That would have exempted the purchase of energy efficient lawn equipment from the state's sales tax, and encouraged more people to ditch their gas powered leaf blowers and other various yard appliances for ones that are electric or battery operated. That didn't get through, but you know, the climate continues to cook, so I'm sure they'll look at it again next year. And another major area that did not have any meaningful changes, and the good news here is Republicans in the legislature were pushing this year for tax cuts. Now, bear in mind that Washington State has the by far the most regressive tax system in the country due to our lack of a progressive income tax. So more tax cuts equals more regression. It's a bad idea. Fortunately, that was blocked, but Democrats themselves didn't make any serious effort after last year's capital gains tax was passed and then tied up in court. Hold on a second. They did not make any serious effort this year to try and reform the state's tax system. Now, the state Supreme Court is going to consider this year whether to overturn that that state ban on income taxes. A lower judge in Douglas County a couple weeks ago did overturn the new capital gains tax because he considered it income tax. That's going to go to the state Supreme Court. Sponsors of that bill and advocates for it had hoped that it would face a legal challenge that would empower a relatively progressive state Supreme Court to finally overturn the state's ban on income taxes. You know, we'll see where that goes. But nothing happened on that front this year at all. So that was disappointing. And then Maria has talked in past weeks about efforts to undo some of the 2021 session's police accountability measures that were implemented. And that was disappointing as well. So, yeah, as you said, overall, not a very stellar legislative session. Busy as usual, but from the standpoint of trying to get progressive policy enacted, not much positive happened. You know, a few things on climate change, a few things on housing, but really that was about it. Nibbling around the edges of huge, major problems in the state.
And we've been talking about on this show for a couple decades now about the state having the legislature in house 24/7, as opposed to, you know, 60 and 90 or 120 days out of the year.
Yeah, and the other piece of that is they need more staff support too. They get a couple staff people a piece as legislators, elected officials, but they really need more than that to be able to review and intelligently be able to vote on literally a couple thousand bills a session. It's just insane. You know, people who work for the legislative offices down there literally get a hotel room for a couple of months down in Olympia, and then they don't sleep. And these are mostly young people without a lot of experience, and they don't get paid very well. You know, it looks good on the resume. It's that kind of job. But it is physically brutal.
Yeah, I think they were trying to even push for unionization this year, and that got pushed back. So,
of course, yes, because the state legislature, in its infinite wisdom, exempted itself from most labor laws.
All right, let's move on then to this week's continuing COVID pandemic news.
Yeah, the pandemic is still out there. We've been talking for a couple months about declining rates of new infections, both here and across the country. That rate is starting to reverse because we've got a new subvariant of Omicron. It's called BA.2. It has not gotten its own name yet, but it's about 30% of infections now in New York City, according to an analysis of wastewater that was publicized yesterday. The last CDC estimate is nationally, it's about 23% of new infections. I have not seen an estimate of Washington State yet, but Washington State's steady decline over the past couple months is slowing down, has basically stopped, and is likely going to reverse in the next week or two, especially with the statewide mask mandate having been lifted last weekend. So the pandemic is not over yet. And, you know, Maria and I have been saying for weeks and weeks and weeks, this is what happens when you lift pandemic restrictions, is the pandemic comes back. And we are now starting to see that. It's very discouraging. Also discouraging is that, you know, what's happening in Europe, which has frequently been a precursor for what happens in North America, is getting worse as well. Infections are increasing again, for instance, in Great Britain, in Germany. And this is, you know, not counting the pandemic chaos that's being unleashed by the refugee crisis in Eastern Europe. Which is going to be very good for the virus as well. You know, even before the invasion, both Russia and Ukraine had very high infection rates. Ukraine has not issued new numbers for 3 weeks now, which is not a surprise. And Russia's is going up quite dramatically. So, the other part of the world that's in big trouble because of Omicron is China and Eastern Asia. We've been talking about Eastern Asia for a couple weeks, but China really started getting moving into an emergency status this week. Several major cities, including Beijing and Shanghai, and the major industrial and port city of Shenzhen, which is near Hong Kong and Guangdong in southern China, and through which much of the stuff that you see in Walmart passes in order to get to your shelves, always the lowest price. They are all in lockdown now. So that's going to interfere with the supply chain also and have global implications for the purchase of, you know, cheap goods, but also a lot of expensive electronics and things like that. That's going to have global economic implications. We're not out of the pandemic yet by a long shot. I would keep wearing a mask in indoor unventilated areas. I would keep social distancing from people. I know it sucks, but, stay safe. I have a good friend who got infected with COVID just this past week, and she's recovering. She's okay, but it's still scary. And you never know whether your genetic disposition is such that the virus is going to hit you a lot harder than it hits other people.
Yeah. I saw at least one country in Eastern Europe, which had previously removed its mask mandates, is instituting those again. So,
and again, yeah, and that's, you're gonna see that with more countries. Yep.
And the other side of that is, having been out several times this week, I noticed, even though some of the places I went to, the employees didn't have masks on, in large part. The stores I went to had, everybody was pretty much, or at least, you know, 90% of people were continuing to wear masks, and even out in the street, I saw a lot of people, like in the U district, I saw a lot of people still wearing masks, even outside. So,
well, that's good. I mean, I wear a mask anytime I step out of the home, basically.
I hear you.
It's a very low-cost measure that you can take to prevent a potentially catastrophic outcome.
Moving on to national and federal grand jury in Louisville. Is that right?
Yep, it is. Yeah, they indicted a former police officer this week for something she did on duty. Now, this stems, again, from the post-George Floyd protests, which were quite spirited, shall we say, in Louisville because of the previous shooting of Breonna Taylor. During one of those protests in, I believe, June or July of 2020, a local business owner, a guy who ran a very popular barbecue joint, an African-American man named David McAtee, was shot and killed by a Kentucky National Guard member. Now, it turns out the reason that the guard member shot at him, he was violating a curfew by standing in front of his business trying to protect it. Now, all the guard member saw was a big black guy in front of a building, with a gun. which was, he had a right to have, and he had registered it and all that. But the reason the guard member shot at him and wound up killing him was that they had heard gunshots. He thought he had an active shooter situation on his hands. He didn't. But what the supposed gunshots that he heard was pepper balls being fired at the business owner by a Louisville police officer named Katie Cruz. So she is the person who has been indicted this past week by the grand jury on a charge of using unreasonable force, because she fired at him for no other reason than he was standing there. It was in violation of a curfew, he was on his own property. He had a right to be there. And she again just saw a black guy standing in front of a building, and that is what led directly to his death, unfortunately. So she has been indicted. Now I don't know how serious a charge that is, but she will go to trial for it. And again, having law enforcement officers of any kind charged for something they did while on duty is still vanishingly rare in this country. Mm-hmm. So rare enough that I can, feature it almost every time it happens. That stemmed out of those protests in 2020 as well.
And Supreme Court nominee gets a hearing on Monday, this coming Monday?
Yes. Mark your calendar. Not just Monday, it'll be all week. Mm-hmm. But Ketanji Brown Jackson will face the Senate Judicial Committee before having her nomination go to the full Senate for a vote. The committee will vote on it first. It's expected to be largely partisan because Republicans don't believe that a Democratic president has a right to nominate a Supreme Court justice. By all accounts, she's incredibly well qualified. She is the first African-American woman ever to be nominated for, much less appointed to the Supreme Court. And usually these hearings aren't very newsworthy because the nominees have learned to avoid answering any questions directly. Anything that can be held against them, basically. So we'll see how it goes this coming week, but it is a historic occasion. As I said, she is a first among Supreme Court nominees, and she has a lot of experience. She's been on the D.C. Court of Appeals for, I believe, 8 or 9 years. She is best known, probably, for her opinion late in the Trump administration, where Trump was suing to avoid having to respond to a congressional subpoena for records. Her memorable one-liner was, "The president is not a king." That's what she's known for. But she has a much longer and more distinguished record than just that. She has a very good reputation, which Republicans will do their best to try and smear in the coming week. But hopefully she gets appointed to the court, where she will be writing minority opinions for many years to come.
Well, that leaves us about 10 minutes to talk about Ukraine.
Yeah, and I just want to highlight a few things. I mean, I'm not going to go over everything because, of course, Ukraine has been much in the news. It's kind of hard to miss the past 3 weeks now. It was very interesting that President Zelensky basically did a Zoom tour of legislative bodies on Monday. He spoke to the UK's parliament. Tuesday was Canada's parliament. Wednesday was the US Congress. And then Thursday was the parliament in Germany. He tailored his remarks to each body did a really good job. People were moved in all of those bodies. Certainly the reception that he got in U.S. Congress was notable, particularly from, many of the same Republicans who talked afterwards about how concerned they were about, Ukraine and defending Ukraine from Russia. Now, mind you, these are almost all the same Republicans who voted in 2019 to acquit Donald Trump of charges that he withheld, you know, an arms shipment from Ukraine because he didn't, you know, he wanted Zelensky to do a favor. And Zelensky is relatively new then. We didn't know a lot about him. But we now know that the kind of intestinal fortitude that he is required to stand up to a superpower leader like that was not an accident, that he has a lot of that kind of fortitude in other more alarming situations as well. So so that's how he spent his week. Meanwhile, Russia spent its week stepping up its targets on civilian areas within Ukraine. And most concerning, and this has not gotten a lot of media attention, but they're using a lot more cruise missiles being fired from the Black Sea, which travel several hundred miles to reach their destinations. This is what they used for that theater in Mariupol that was bombed on Thursday with, you know, somewhat fruitlessly with the word children painted on both sides of the ground in front of the building to dissuade bombers. But this is a cruise missile. This is not something that a human being is watching. They just dial in the coordinates and let it fly. About 130 people have been rescued from bomb shelter underneath that building, which was reduced to rubble so far. Reportedly, more people are still trapped in there, and rescue efforts have been complicated by the fact that Russians are continuing to shell the buildings. So that was one cruise missile. There were also cruise missiles that hit Kyiv and the western city of Lviv and Kharkiv yesterday. You know, these are missiles that carry a bigger payload than the simple shelling that Russia's mostly been doing this past week. And, you know, they're being targeted largely at residential areas, which, of course, is a war crime. Joe Biden came out and called Putin a war criminal this week, which, got more attention than really it deserved. Because, you know, words are words. And, you know, we see this, we see the peace talks that were held all this past week, where there's, you know, the parties are saying that there's progress, but there's no real sign of it. And even if, you know, they come to some sort of a ceasefire agreement, nobody expects Russia to honor it. Certainly the temporary ceasefire agreements that have been cut in cities like Mariupol to allow civilians to escape from the Russian siege because they haven't had any food or water or electricity or heat or anything for, you know, over a week now. This is a city of 400,000 people. Every time one of those ceasefire agreements has been agreed to, the Russians have simply ignored it. They continue to shell the areas where the refugees are trying to get out, and the refugees wind up not being able to get out. A few thousand people have managed to escape Mariupol this week, no thanks to the Russians. That negotiation process has been going underway. The UN Security Council has held several meetings this past week, and you know it's all words. It doesn't change what's happening on the ground, and what's happening on the ground is a catastrophe. You know, we have 3.3 million people, as I mentioned, that have now fled Ukraine for other parts of Europe. We have another 6.5 million people, according to the UN, who have been displaced within Ukraine, you know, mostly migrating to the western part of the country, which has been relatively safe, relatively free of Russian bombardment or Russian troops. The Russian troops have been stalled in their advances and their efforts to, for instance, encircle Kyiv and take Kharkiv, and they still haven't taken Mariupol. They're really not moving very much at all. The Ukrainian forces have been holding them off. It's the shelling at this point and the cruise missiles that are doing the most damage and providing the most breathless footage for Western TV. And, you know, this you know, every expert in the area says, you know, Putin is not going to let up. He's continued to give really bellicose speeches this past week. And this could go on for weeks and weeks. So it is truly a humanitarian catastrophe, as most war is. But, you know, this is one that we're watching in real time.
Yeah, Stephen Zunis, who you know.
Yes.
Posted today a reminder. He posted 19 years ago today, Bush ordered the start of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Even though Saddam had been allowing for unfettered U.N. inspectors for several months and they're finding none of the weapons of mass destruction, the U.S. claimed Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chair Joe Biden praised the decision, saying, quote, "I support the president. Diplomacy over avoiding war is dead. I do not see any alternative. It is not as if we can back away now," adding, "let loose the dogs of war."
Yeah, so just remember that Biden was chair of the Senate Armed Services Committee for a number of years. He was probably, of all the Democrats in the Senate, the most hawkish Democrat. And that was my major reservation of him when he ran for president in 2020, is his foreign policy record. I think he has done, let me put it this way, a better job than I expected in terms of, you know, withdrawing from Afghanistan and his response to the Ukraine crisis, et cetera. That all being said, I am getting really tired of people on the left who are engaging in the kind of whataboutism that you often see from the right, where, you know, well, you know, Putin's not that bad. The United States has no standing to you know, criticize him because they do bad things too. Well, you know, what is it my mom said, you know, all those years ago? Two wrongs don't make a right. U.S. foreign policy does not justify Russian foreign policy. And, you know, what Russia is doing is a war crime. Period. End of story. The fact that every U.S. president since World War II, at least, has arguably been a war criminal, is besides the point. That's not what we're talking about here. What we're talking about is Russian aggression. And it's not anti-Russia to say that its leader is a war criminal, and a war criminal playing out in on our TVs in real time. One more caveat, because I know we got to wrap up. I would seek out non-Western news sources, places like Al Jazeera. You know, even Israeli media has been far, far better and more nuanced on this war than American media has been. American media, as usual, you know, pretends to be experts on a country they only heard of, you know, the week before last, and is very American-centric. For instance, I think the Biden's phone call with Xi yesterday morning was probably the most critical thing that happened this week. China has way more leverage on this situation than the United States does. So watch what China does. And, you know, the way China indicates that they're slowly moving away from Russia, it's usually pretty subtle. You have to look for clues in the Chinese state media and the, you know, Chinese Communist Party media organs. This is something I do, but it's not something most people do. So, but that's going to be a much better indicator of how isolated Russia actually is than what you hear in American media. I've also seen interviews this week with, you know, a man on the street kind of interviews, woman on the street in places like Moscow. And what they consistently bring up as the effect of the sanctions is, I really miss McDonald's. You know, I'm sure that it's an improvement for their diet, but at the same time, it's a kind of a sad commentary on, you know, what kind of things people take value most in, you know, Western corporations.